This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're joined by special guest Mumia Abu-Jamal to discuss the aftermath of the Ferguson grand jury verdict.
Tens of thousands have hit the streets. What does this movement foretell? Will it continue? Will we be able to get at endemic police violence? Let's hear it from Mumia.
We're also joined by attorney Larry Saltzman from the Institute for Justice to discuss civil forfeiture and how local police are literally just taking our property away.
Cops can take your car, your briefcase, your money, almost anything. And guess what? They do it without a court order, and they get a percentage of it to help run their departments. Outrageous? Yes.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, Heidi, cities all over the country erupted in protest against the situation that developed in Ferguson last week, letting the cop off the hook on that murder. And Michael, you were part of the demonstration here in New York last week. What was it like?
You know, we had 2 days of demonstrations, and it was a remarkable feeling of empowerment, of anger, of people taking over the city. One of the ones I was on last week, we started at Union Square. There were thousands of people, all with signs, you know, hands up, don't shoot, signs about racism and the cops, signs about the two people in New York who've been murdered by cops over the last few months, and we can talk about those. But what was amazing about it, of course, they were very diverse. High percentage of blacks, Latinos, Asians, etc. And we started in Union Square, which is around 14th Street. On the first day, marched up to 125th Street, over on 125th Street to the east. And then some people, by that time, early in the morning of the next day, sat down in the middle of the BQE, which is a major artery connecting Manhattan to Queens and Brooklyn, and stopped all the traffic. And the cops couldn't do anything. You realize that the cops had no ability to control tens of thousands of people, perhaps, certainly many thousands, taking over all the streets in New York. The next day, I went back to Union Square Park, and again, it began with a similar kind of thing, thousands of people in the park, and just doing whatever they wanted, essentially, in terms of the streets. We marched around the park. We then went on to 14th Street. On 14th Street, just right in the traffic, everything stopped completely. No cops anywhere to be seen, really. Walked on 14th Street. Then you take a left turn down 6th Avenue, take 6th Avenue all the way to Washington Square Park, walk around Washington Square Park. They wouldn't let us into the park. That they had rows of police around it. My thinking is they didn't want to let people into the park because they figured they'd never get the people out of the park without using force, and the park closes supposedly at 1. Then walk through the West Village, up 7th Avenue, and I'm telling you, we're going in between cars. This is like, the cars aren't moving. Dead stop traffic for hours, Washington Square Park down, with people who are on the march taking control of the traffic. You know, stopping the cars from coming over, opening up the street so that we could walk. It was an incredible feeling of empowerment, and the understanding that this isn't just a Ferguson issue, because as we talk about, you know, there were two people, as I said, recently murdered in New York. Both of them people should know about. One is Eric Garner, who was in Staten Island, was stopped apparently for trying to sell, like, cigarettes outside of the tax system or something. I'm not sure what it was.
Loose cigarette.
Cop stops him and puts him in a chokehold and murders him. In my view, kills him. I mean, murders him.
Five
I mean,
six
I think.
Kids.
Yeah, I mean, it was incredible. And chokehold should have been barred. The guy is screaming, he can't breathe. I think people were there and he wasn't saved. So there's, again, a black man killed, murdered, in my view. Secondly, the other case is Ake Gurley, which just happened, you know, 10 days ago or so. A young man with his girlfriend walking in a stairwell in New York. Darkened stairwell, and we'll talk about that in a second. A cop who's patrolling, apparently we don't know the story because no one's really spoken, somehow had his gun out, and the gun, one shot, killed this young, innocent man. Every newspaper reporting, everybody says innocent. And my outrage at that story is not only that, you know, cops are walking around with their guns, you know, their hands on their guns. Bratton called it accidental shooting. Well, this is not necessarily about the particular individual who did that. This is a whole racist police department. But also what outraged me in the word accidental, why are the housing projects in New York, why are their hallways bulbs not changed when they burn out? There's no accident in that. These are poor people living in city housing, and they're basically forced to walk through dark halls at night in areas that have some crime. And so I'm not saying taking away anything from the whatever the cop did and why, but that our mayor and others aren't saying, get those halls lit right away. This is no accident. Anyway, it was an incredible week of seeing this, not just in New York, but around the country. And the last note, when Haida, I know, is anxious to ask me something here. Last week's march, on the second day, they closed every single entrance into Manhattan. What I saw with just my part of the march that I described from Union Square down to the West Village, it was going on everywhere. There was a picture of Times Square of thousands of people. There were pictures in front of the tunnels. Every single bridge, entrance, and egress to the city was shut down. An incredible outpouring. And you understand, and I'll just finish on this note, why governments fear so much popular uprisings. You understand that without killing people, they probably, when they really happen, they can't stop them. And that's a huge issue, and you saw a beginning of that with Ferguson.
Michael, I wanted to add that last week we saw really an incredible outpouring of young people at these demonstrations in New York City and across the country. And I was walking home on the second evening, and I live on 14th Street between Avenues B and C, and there I saw six horse trucks with horses waiting and officers standing by. And what I thought was interesting, as I went into a local bodega, a young man was there and he's like, what are all those horses doing? What would they want those for? And I said, well, they typically use horses and canine units literally as weapons to push people in crowds, which he found astonishing. But I think what we're going to see is a new generation of people who take to the streets and who haven't yet been exposed to the kind of police repression that all of us are so familiar with. So I think there's going to be a learning curve.
De Blasio has done a number of good things for the city. There's still a lot of criticism of him on Bratton, and who's our police commissioner. But I had the feeling yesterday that the cops had been told, just let this thing go. I mean, how could we walk down one of the busiest streets in New York, 6th Avenue, every car stopped, and the cops not push us out of the way or say you can't go there? Is that a shift in your view? Is that something, our other mayor was obviously awful on this stuff, Bloomberg. I'm not saying de Blasio is incredible on this issue, but we were not beaten.
No, I think it's a conscious shift on de Blasio's part. However, in addition to those horses who I think were on standby, I also saw on Avenue C and 9th Street, there's a police precinct, and there were rows of scooters, which are not usually there. I think they were having in a sort of backup on hold position in case they decided to escalate force. So I think his frontline approach is one of restraint, but we'll have to see when push comes to shove.
Going back to what you said, Heidi, with all these young people and what Michael said about how this is going on all over, I think it's more than a hope. I think this is a real indication of a rebirth of the civil rights movement. One of the leaders out in Ferguson was interviewed by Amy Goodman. He said, Obama, we gave you 6 years. And people are I think, starting to understand the nature of this government. And they're starting to understand intelligence is now coordinated. And the police have been militarized with all this equipment. The army has dumped on them. And you have to say that the sophisticated people in this government, I am sure, understood that push would come to shove and there would be a moment when they would need this. And they started doing this right after 9/11. So what we've been talking about on this show for the last 10 years is coming to fruition. On the one hand, you've got this really organized force of repression. But on the other hand, you have a lot of people out on the streets. And what we like to say is, you got enough people, you make your own permit and you make your own rules. And that's what we saw happen last week.
I am hopeful that this will continue. I would offer one word of caution. We saw with the Occupy movement how that level of coordination, Michael Smith, that you just spoke about, really came into play, where the Department of Homeland Security coordinated even before the first Occupy encampment to work with local banks and financial institutions to share intelligence, be it through fusion centers or otherwise, and really clamp down on a boisterous movement that sparked feelings in people, and I think that really had the potential to change this country. I hope that doesn't happen with the Ferguson-related comings together.
I think it's a question of leadership, and I think you're starting to see leadership evolving now out of these demonstrations. What happened in New York City wasn't an accident. With that leadership, which was absent during Occupy, which was consciously absent, but I think people are understanding that. You have to make demands. You have to have those demands coordinated. There's nothing wrong with leadership as long as it's a democratic one, and I think that that lesson has been learned, and we really took a giant step forward last week.
You know, I hope you're right, Michael. I'm worried, like Heidi is, that we have these massive outpourings, and they seem to be continuing longer than I would have expected, which is what's positive, and I think I agree with you on that. But I am worried that, you know, a few more weeks pass by, and there's not a basis for the demands, there's not the leadership we need. But who knows? Because this is going on all over the country, and people understand that black people are being murdered all over the country, and people are upset by it. And I agree with Heidi, the young people issue is really strong here. The other thing I think that was really interesting to me in the coverage of the Ferguson grand jury, I don't know if people have listened to the prosecutor's statement or read it. They should, because it's one of the more racist, biased statements publicly that you could make, and you understand how entrenched the white police power structure is in this country. But the Times coverage and others have gone out of their way to say how this grand jury was not a fair grand jury, that the questioning of the cop who did the killing, Wilson, was much more easygoing when he appeared before the grand jury. They let him sort of tell his story, but they challenged the witnesses very heavily to try and make the grand jury understand which side the prosecutor was on here. And I think that coverage has been interesting to me. You've never seen that before.
Also, I read that there were no questions asked by the members of the grand jury. And what does that say to you, Michael, that they're just taking sort of what the prosecutor's line is on face value?
Well, I think it was a manipulated grand jury. A grand jury sits for one purpose, and that's to determine the probability of a crime being committed and the likelihood that a certain individual or individuals did it. That's all they're supposed to do. Grand juries will go over a case for a day or two, and that's it. This prosecutor did what you could call a data dump on this grand jury, kept him busy for 3 months and drowned him in all kinds of contradictory facts and witnesses, and then told them, didn't guide them, which is what a prosecutor is supposed to do, but told them, you guys decide. You know,
like a jury instead.
Well, there are 12 people on a grand jury. Out there, you need 10 people to get an indictment. So three people can block indicting the cop. All you need is three. And when you do a data dump and you go on for 3 months and you confuse three people, you get a no indictment. And that's what you got out of it.
You got out of it, Michael, but it was biased. I'm saying it wasn't just he just dumped it in there. The way he asked the questions of the people, the witnesses, the many witnesses, was very biased according to all the readings I've read. He was very easygoing on the cop and very tough on the witnesses who contradicted the cop. So it wasn't just he dumped it in there. He had a goal, and the goal was to have that grand jury come back with no indictment.
Yeah, and why? Because prosecutors work daily hand in glove with cops. That's what they do, and that's what they did here to shield the cop. I think that there's a wide understanding that this thing was fixed from the beginning.
Well, and also, one final note, these are people who go back to their community whose identities, even though they're supposed to be protected, will probably at some point come out, given the length of time they served on this. And I wonder if, given the very pro-police, racist, conservative area that they're from, that there wasn't a certain level of intimidation about deviating from the status quo.
I'm sure that's true, and I'm sure that the story will come out, and probably sooner rather than later. All it takes is one of these grand jurors to come forward and say, this is what went on. And you know, that Ferguson community, it's a black community. Two-thirds are black. 95% of the cops are white, and they don't live in that community, nor does the prosecutor.
Well, hopefully, as we're at the beginning of perhaps starting to end, basically, black murders by cops. But it's going to take a long struggle. But it's been amazing, really amazing.
Well, it's going to take black people in their communities controlling their community and controlling the police department there, having civilian review boards with teeth. Bruce Wright, famous black judge here in New York City, used to say, you got to give psychological tests to these cops when you put them on the force, because you don't want a cop that feels threatened, his authority threatened, and lashes out. He said, that's what happens in all the police brutality cases that came before Judge Wright. He saw there's something, these cops are something wrong. And this particular cop that murdered Mike Brown, this guy's 6'4", and he said he felt intimidated by an 18-year-old, like he was only a 5-year-old kid being strangled by Hulk Hogan. So this guy, his authority was challenged, and he felt threatened. This guy should have never been on the force to begin with, and they put him in there to control what he thought was an alien community.
Right, but he shouldn't have been on the force. But the problem is not the individuals. It's the whole set of people on these police forces and what their ideology is. I mean, you know, this is not new, obviously, as people know, particularly people in black communities know, having their kids killed. And we've had it in New York constantly. And, you know, we had a period in the 60s when, or in the 50s, when it was just, you know, rampant killings of blacks, just rampant. And in some way what happened is some blacks fought back and they started killing cops. And that's the situation we had because it got so rampant. You know, I'm not saying that should or will happen again, but they've got to finally, and maybe this will be a moment when we begin to see some shift. It's going to take a long time.
Renowned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal joins us today to discuss the widespread outrage at last week's grand jury decision in Missouri not to indict Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson for the fatal shooting of Michael Brown, an unarmed African-American 18-year-old. Welcome, Mumia, to Law and Disorder.
Hey, how y'all doing?
We're okay, Mumia. How are you doing?
Well, I always say fair to middling, but, you know, sometimes better, sometimes worse. Yeah. This is better.
We wanted to get your impression about really the phenomenal set of protests that have happened across 170 cities in response to the Ferguson verdict. What are your thoughts about this?
When you think back, right, through American history, there are actually few periods where you see this range of protests. I mean, you'll see, of course, throughout the 20th century protests. But think about April 4th, 1968, the day Martin Luther King was killed, and you saw protests all across the country, over 100 cities. The fact that we can look back to that event so long ago and then look what happened just a few hours ago and see perhaps a greater range of protests, but certainly over 170 cities, tells you, I think, better than anything I can say, that things are very bad indeed in terms of the African-American community and their expectation of justice in this system. This is a vote no. This is not a political election, but it's certainly people voting. Think about this. When you look at the weather in many of these cities, people coming out in the dire cold, right, to protest at night. That's not an easy thing. People don't do that easily. And they do it at considerable risk and some danger. That speaks to the depth of the feeling in their hearts that something is broken in the American justice system.
Mumia, I think your historical perspective is really important because it is something that
Hold
has
on,
set...
Michael. This guy's screaming in the back. All right. Sorry about that.
I really appreciate your historical perspective. And my worries, of course, I was out there last night and it was incredible because basically the streets were taken over by the people. I mean, there were cars everywhere. The cops were nowhere to be seen. You could just walk on every street in New York, all the way down 6th Avenue, et cetera. But I'm worried, and it has escalated, certainly, since the murder in Ferguson. But how do you see the future? How is it going to keep going and changing?
Well, you know, I could come up with something sexy in terms of predicting, but you know and I know that that depends on the people, and it also depends on the people who are able to organize the people. It can dissipate, you know, into anger, and also disaffection and disconnection, which is very deep in American society now. I mean, the recent midterms election I read or heard was the lowest turnout since the 1940s. That says something about American discontent with the political system. Or it can turn into real activism of a kind we have not seen in generations that really takes charge and addresses these issues that obviously lie in the hearts of many, many people. You know, when I was in broadcasting formally, as opposed to as now an outlaw, I used to listen to my program director and talk about something called ascertainment. And he was explaining to me that back then, under the old Telecommunications Act, every year, and several times a year, management of the radio station would sit down and they would go over the mail they got and, you know, phone calls. And they would look at one letter and say, that represents 1,000 people. Because 1 out of 1,000 people will write a letter. Well, today it's new media, so it's probably easier to email. But still, you know, very few people actually act out and demonstrate despite their feelings. When you look at these kinds of numbers, it actually reminds me of the demonstrations before.
This call is from the State Correctional Institution at Mahanoy and is subject to monitoring and recording.
The demonstrations before the 2003 Iraq War, where all around the world, literally, in hundreds of countries, you saw demonstrations that were almost unprecedented. People feel that, right? Now, that can either dissipate to a new provocation, but I think it's so deep in the American mind that it will not go away.
You know, I'd like to think so, and I think you're right, but of course, your example of the Iraq War is a very good one, because there we had probably the biggest anti-war demonstrations in the world for, you know, a very long time. And of course, they went ahead with that completely, you know, barbaric war, and then it dissipated. And people said, right, well, what's the point of doing this? And so the question is, how is this going to be different?
Well, I think it not just dissipated, but also kind of a lot of people turned away from the political system, as I said earlier. This is the time where organizers should be on their P's and Q's and out there and taking phone numbers and taking email addresses and, you know, old-fashioned street addresses and you know, building lists so that people can be contacted in the future. And really, towards the perspective of building organizations. Organizations matter. Movements matter. And you cannot allow this moment to pass without really trying, at the best of our abilities, right, to organize this energy, this mass discontent.
I mean, I think that's completely right. I mean, what, you know, people made parallels, well, what if it's like Occupy? But there you exactly didn't have what you're suggesting now, which is organizations and movements and leadership and et cetera. So I think that's right.
Mumia, I wanted to ask you about something we've discussed, and that's Obama's comment about following the law. What is your response, especially to young people who may be taking to the streets for the first time?
I think when young people hear that, they will not understand it. I mean, I'm 60 and I don't understand it. to stand up at this moment, the first African-American president in America's history, and talk about that people need to observe and respect the rule of law is, I think, frankly, absurd, especially given what we know about the history of law. For example, you know, Barack Hussein Obama was born on August 4th, 1961. In that year, there were perhaps 20 states that made it illegal for a white person to marry a black person. That is, it was a crime. People went to jail for what they called interracial fornication. and getting married was illegal, right? He was born in 1961, as I said earlier. 1967 comes around. Loving versus Virginia. The United States Supreme Court, 9-0, rules that laws outlawing interracial marriage are unconstitutional. So Barack Obama was a six-year-old boy, right, living in a state up until that date, right, that the Supreme Court ruled, a state of crime. His parents, if they were in any of those southern states, would have been, you know, not just separated, but thrown into jail, right? That was the rule of law for perhaps a third of the United States. So when you talk about the rule of law, you have to talk about the rule of right and the rule of wrong. And to quote John Africa, he says, just because it's legal, don't make it right. We live in a country that legalized slavery. We know in the world that the German Reich legalized the Holocaust. Many things are done in the name of law, but they're wrong. They're simply wrong. And when people protest, no matter how strenuously they protest, they're trying to get their leaders to say, this is wrong, not you must obey the rule of law. You know, you look at Ferguson, the rule of law is armed, you know, not just shooting tear gas, but armed with sniper rifles and Humvees and, you know, tanks and Star Wars clothing and automatic weapons. It's not the rule of right, though.
I'm glad you quoted that from John Africa, because there was one that I just heard the other day from Howard Zinn, which goes, quote, protest beyond the law is not a departure from democracy. It is absolutely essential to it. And I think that's a
true Zennism. Mm-hmm. I was thinking about Howard, right? And that sounds like Howard. And he knew that because when he was a young professor at Spelman, you know, he was teaching these young black kids pre-law and about the Constitution. They were saying, well, Professor Zinn, I know you say I have the right to practice the First Amendment and the right, you know, under the Constitution, but when I go out and protest for civil rights, I get beat in my head. I get locked up. And he had nothing to say. And Howard looked and said, well, how can I tell these kids about something when they know in their lives it's not true? And that's when Howard began learning from his students. And he became the Howard Zinn of legend and, you know, founded his own historical school, a people's history of, right? And he learned that at Spelman, you know, and one of his students was the brilliant Alice Walker, right? We can talk about the law, we can talk about the rule of law, but what people experience, and let me give you an example on that. I was reading the USA last week. I'm a little behind in my reading. And they said 461 people were killed by police in 2013. 461. The average in the last 7 to 10 years was about 100 a year. I think this is bigger than Michael Brown. I think this is far bigger than Mike Brown. And I think that's why you have this profound response from 170-plus cities across the United States. I don't know what it is across the country. I mean, around the world. But I imagine it's probably even greater numbers because, you know, this is the United States and everybody sees what happens in the United States.
I mean, I think people understand exactly what you're saying. And look at in New York, what did we have in the last few months? We had the chokehold death, you know, of Garner. We had Ake Gurley's murder in the hallway in a housing project that wasn't well lit as 12-year-old in Cleveland. And so this is, I would say, epidemic. That may not be the right word, but what you're saying, that's why I think there's so much resonance in the black community. I think they understand that their children go out and they can be murdered.
That's right. You know, literally at the blink of an eye. I just heard about this Cleveland, you know, story, this 12-year-old kid. And I'm blanking on the guy's name, but it was a elderly gentleman retired from the New York...
This call is from the State Correctional Institution at Mahanoy and is subject to monitoring and recording.
The New York Department of Corrections, the police come to his apartment because he inadvertently pushed, you know, a medical alert. And he's telling them at his door, like, I'm cool, I'm all right. And they begin calling him niggers and, you know, slandering this guy. And they end up getting in an altercation with this elderly gentleman and causing his death in his apartment. This is a former correctional officer.
You have 60 seconds remaining.
A retired correctional officer. So, I mean, this is bigger than young kids, right? This is bigger than young black kids, big kids, little kids, you know, elderly men. You know, it's something that's systemic. That's a problem in the United States, and the people are trying to draw attention to it. And I don't think it's successful, but I think it's a damn good beginning. How about that?
How about that, Mumia? We're running out of time. It's really been a joy to hear your voice on Law and Disorder.
Remarkable, and really, thank you.
Heidi and Michael, the pleasure is mine, as I said.
Big hug of solidarity and support, Mumia.
Thank you, brother. Thank you all.
Okay.
And I want to move Long Live John Africa and join that movement out there, people.
Come on, we wish you were on the streets with us, I'll tell you that.
Well, you're in our hearts.
That's what I'm talking about.
Hey, mister. Take
thank
care.
You.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
No justice, no peace. No racism.
We'll leave you with some audio that our own Michael Ratner recorded in the streets of New York at last week's protest.
No justice, no peace. No racist police. No justice, no peace. No racist, we as hell. Convict, send those cops to jail. The whole damn system is guilty as hell.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. In May 2013, two Internal Revenue Service agents seized the checking account of Carol Hinders with a $32,000 balance. Hinders was accused of structuring her deposits to be less than $10,000 to avoid filing required government reports. It's a tactic often used by drug dealers and others to move money around without detection. But Carol Hinders owns a Mexican restaurant, and her business is cash only. She explained this to the IRS. Although she wasn't charged with a crime, the IRS still seized her money. There are many cases of civil forfeiture, similar to Carol's. It's becoming a growing concern as the value of seized assets has skyrocketed to over $4 billion in 2012. We're joined today by attorney Larry Saltzman from the Institute for Justice. He's taken on Carol's legal defense. Welcome, Larry, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Let's start by describing exactly what is civil forfeiture.
Well, civil forfeiture is a set of laws that allow government agencies to take your property when they suspect that it's been involved in crime, but they don't need to charge you with any crime to take that property.
And often they use the property for local police departments, or what else do they do with it?
One of the incredible things about civil forfeiture is that the agencies that seize your money, based on a mere suspicion, actually get to keep that money to fund their agencies. That's true in most states and also of the federal law. So, for instance, if the IRS or the Department of Homeland Security were to take cash from you because they think it's involved in some crime, that money actually goes to the Treasury Department to be used to pad the budgets of the agencies that then seize more money.
There's some incentive here. Let's talk about the growth of this practice. Who does it? What do they do? Who's affected?
Every state is engaged in civil forfeiture. Minnesota recently had a reform. They no longer use strictly civil forfeiture. They'll only take your property after you've been convicted of a criminal offense, which we think is a great reform. The federal government also uses it. So it's virtually every major agency of the federal government, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the IRS, the Department of Homeland Security, ICE, virtually all the major agencies use civil forfeiture.
Larry, this is Michael Ratner. I want to go back for a second to the point that Michael Smith made about the incentive of police and others to seize the property and just take it because they finance their departments through this. And I remember a case, I'm sure you're familiar, Tommy v. Ohio, where a judge had an interest in the percentage that would of money that he would get for a parking ticket. And of course, the Supreme Court, not of course, but they ruled that unconstitutional. Has that come up in this case? This seems like such a complete outrage to me that they would actually get the goods they seize. It would just make them want to seize everything. I mean, is that litigated at all? What's going on with that?
Well, you make a great point. You know, there's a direct financial incentive to both law enforcement agencies and also to prosecutors' departments. They get to keep this money, and it's driving a huge growth in civil forfeiture. You mentioned that Toomey case. That gets a little bit into the weeds, but that was a case that stood for the proposition that a judge couldn't have a direct financial interest in the fines or the penalties that he was enforcing because it obviously motivates them to engage in an impartial administration of the law. We think the exact same thing is happening with civil forfeiture. You just can't have both civil forfeiture and an impartial enforcement of the law if the agencies enforcing that law get the money.
Now, Larry, I read, and correct me if I'm wrong, that in many cases there will be a hearing initially, and it's presided over not by a judge or neutral magistrate, but by the prosecutor whose very office will be benefiting from the proceeds, and prosecutor who has wide discretion in deciding whether to forfeit the person's property or to give it back. Is that accurate?
I think you're talking about Pennsylvania, and in some states, that's right. Your initial hearing is not actually with a neutral adjudicator, with a judge, but it's with the prosecutors. It's complete violation of due process, and the Institute for Justice is involved in the lawsuit against the city of Philadelphia there to try to end their forfeiture program for that reason, among others. In federal cases, there's another kind of lack of due process, which is when the federal government seizes cash, like a bank account, the law doesn't provide any prompt post-seizure hearing, so there's no right for you to quickly contest the validity of the seizure. So you might wait a year without your money before you ever get to see a judge.
And I also understand that in some cases, people will not challenge the seizure because it costs a lot to litigate. It's just cheaper to let it go.
Oh, sure. I mean, the kind of trifecta here with civil forfeiture is that it's very easy for the government to take your money. They just need the suspicion that it's involved in crime. They don't need to charge you of anything, let alone convict you. It's very hard for you to get it back because it means mounting a full-scale defense in federal court or state court against well-funded prosecutors. That's just beyond the capacity of many people who have a small amount of property taken. If you have, say, $5,000 or $10,000 taken, you just can't afford a lawyer for that. And then, of course, the last element is that there's that financial incentive. So the government is doing more and more of these forfeitures as their budgets are coming under constraint.
Larry, I read recently in a New York Times article, and I wrote this down because it just astounded me. Under a Justice Department program, the value of assets seized has ballooned to $4.3 $1 billion in the 2012 fiscal year from $407 million in 2001. So that's a thousandfold increase in 11 years, up to $4.3 billion. What's your reaction to that?
Well, that is that financial incentive at work. The law changed in 1994 to put that financial incentive in, and ever since then, year by year, the number of forfeitures have gone up, and the number of times prosecutors will, even in maybe a legitimate criminal context where they're pursuing criminal crime, they'll just tack on a forfeiture because they also want the money.
So it goes to local police office.
Yes, it goes to local police departments if it's done under state law, but also under federal law. There's something known as an equitable sharing program.
That's great.
That's a federal program where if local law enforcement involves themselves in a federal forfeiture action, they'll get paid a bounty by the feds for their participation, and that becomes a very meaningful amount of local police department budgets in some cases. Just that program, that equitable sharing program, from the 1990s until today has ballooned from nothing to something over $450 million a year that's given to local police departments.
So it's this well-armed gang taking our money.
It amounts to the federal government providing a bounty to local law enforcement to do an end run around their own state laws that are often more protective of people's property rights.
Larry, we wanted to ask you to discuss one or two of the cases that the Institute for Justice is bringing.
Sure. Well, let me start with the case of Carol Hinders. She's a restaurateur in Iowa. She's owned Mrs. Lady's Mexican Food for 38 years. Just a simple, small business. And it's a cash business. She doesn't take credit cards at her business. She makes frequent cash deposits. And on the basis of nothing more than a series of her cash deposits, the IRS drained her entire bank account, nearly $35,000. It alleged that she, quote, structured her bank deposits. And what that is federal law requires banks to report when people make cash transactions of more than $10,000. If you make deposits smaller than that, the government sometimes says, well, you're structuring your deposits to always make them under 10 so they don't get reported. That's why they took her money. But if they would have just investigated, they would have seen that her deposits correspond to the daily intake, the revenue of her business. She has no interest in hiding from the government. The government has never even alleged that any of this money is the result of any illicit activity or that she's evading taxes. They just say, we don't like the way you deposited your money. It's suspicious, and we're going to take it. And now you have to come sue us and fight a full battle in federal court if you want to get it back. It's an enormous burden, and that's why the Institute for Justice is representing her pro bono. Most people would just have to walk away.
That's an astonishing story.
Yes.
We're all speechless
theft.
Here.
It's really
theft.
Quite amazing.
Yeah, you would think it's a pretty simple premise, but the government should not be using civil forfeiture laws to take money from innocent people like Carol. And we're seeing it again with another set of clients. We have three brothers who own a convenience store distribution business on Long Island. The IRS, again, took $446,000 from them. This is a modest business. Almost all of that money was money that was owed to vendors for inventory. So they grabbed their bank account at a moment where it was, you know, its fullest, basically, and provided the greatest reward to the prosecutors and to the IRS for taking it. And the allegation, again, was structuring. And again, if they would have just investigated, the facts are pretty simple to understand. This is a business that delivers goods to convenience stores. Often they'll deliver candy and cigarettes and other things, and they'll just get paid in cash right out of the till from the convenience store or the bodega. They deposit a lot of cash, and these days if you're using a lot of cash in your business, it comes under suspicion by the IRS. And without any serious investigation, they simply allege, we think your deposits are trying to evade these bank reporting requirements, and we're going to take it, and we're going to make you fight for it back.
That's quite astounding, considering that the banksters who crashed the economy in 2008,
right.
none of them were even prosecuted.
Right.
And there's a guy running a little bodega business on Long Island, and they drained his bank account. Where did the money go after they got the $446,000? Who got it?
Still sitting in account with the U.S. Department of Justice. I mean, what's most shocking about this case, and the reason why the Institute for Justice took on that case, is because here they took the money and have just sat on it for 2.5 years without ever filing any action. There's no allegation of any criminal activity by the Hirsch brothers who own this business. There's not even a civil forfeiture action that's been filed. That's a violation of law in itself that the government's committed, and we're holding them to the fire on that. But they just sat on the money, and hoping that perhaps the brothers will roll over and agree to a giant monetary settlement and let them keep a big chunk of it without ever getting it in front of a judge. And we're not going to let that happen. We're going to have a judge make sure he hears this case.
Well, to make matters worse, I understand it that there are even continuing education seminars for prosecutors and police officials that tell them about how to deal with civil forfeiture. I understand there are sort of wish lists for local police departments about what kinds of products they'd like seized. How has this gotten so out of hand without the protective measures that it sounds like you're trying to make sure happen?
Yeah, it is obscene, and you're right. You know that you may have been reading something. The New Mexico, one of the AGs in New Mexico, or a law enforcement officer in New Mexico, was put on suspension for saying something about those wish lists. You know, out of turn in a continuing legal education course. It's happening all over the place, though. They have these wish lists. And you know, how it's gotten out of control, there's not enough judges overseeing this process. What we need is judges to really engage with limits on the government's power that are in the Constitution to ensure that due process is given in every case, and particularly in civil forfeiture cases where it's gone lacking for so many years.
Tell us a bit about the Institute for Justice. How long have you been around? Do you do other cases in addition to civil forfeiture?
The Institute for Justice was founded in 1991. We're a public interest law firm. We take all of our cases pro bono. And we're really seeking a rule of law under which free and responsible individuals can live their lives, make an honest living.
Larry, this seems such an obvious wrong. Why isn't there more pressure to investigate these practices in addition to what you're doing?
Well, it's finally hit the national stage. You've seen just in the last couple of months, in large measure because of the Institute for Justice's cases, articles in the Washington Post, articles in the New York Times, articles in the Wall Street Journal, all calling for investigation reform of civil forfeiture. There's been bills in the last legislative session in Congress introduced that would help put more teeth in the due process of civil forfeiture, which we welcome. So this is finally getting traction, but I think it's just gone undercover because the financial incentives are there. The prosecutors and law enforcement community love this and have fought hard to make sure that they have huge discretion and great incentives to do more of this. And finally, people are waking up to the abuse that's occurring.
I wonder if there's residual public relations fallout from campaigns years ago, the so-called war on drugs, where you'd see law enforcement going in and seizing property of big drug dealers, and you'd see the attendant public relations campaign with that. So perhaps that added to sort of the vilification of certain individuals, and maybe a naive public thought it was acceptable to seize some assets like that if they were going to support so-called unlawful activities.
I think that's right. Many of the worst aspects of civil forfeiture were ushered in on the premise that they were needed to combat drug trafficking or other elements of the war on drugs. But now we see civil forfeiture being used to treat legitimate small businesses like criminals just because they're making frequent cash deposits. That's waking people up to what's going on.
Larry, I read a long article in the Times about this, and some of the anecdotes were really amusing, awful, but also amusing, like a couple who lost their home because their child was caught doing a $40 drug deal, or another guy that had a fancy sports car, and the cops were talking about how much they wanted it and waiting for a chance to pounce on it. You must get some really awful incidences that come across your desk, and I wonder whether you'd share those with us.
Well, I do get quite a few. You know, certainly the Iowa and Long Island cases are hair-raising. You know, you have hardworking people who, you know, in Carol's case, Carol Hinders in Iowa, lost $35,000. In the case of the Hirsch brothers in Long Island, I mean, that's as much as most people save in a lifetime that they're now fighting for. Those cases and many others show that the forfeiture reform is just needed, both at the states and the federal level. The bottom line is that people shouldn't lose their property without being convicted of a crime. And law enforcement shouldn't be able to profit from other people's property the way they do with civil forfeiture. We see people all over the place. For instance, in Michigan, I represented a grocer, small grocery store. He was also making frequent cash deposits. people come and pay for their groceries for cash. He has to deposit that money in a bank. Can't keep it all in the store all the time. And he had an insurance policy that said, if your store is robbed, you won't be covered for more than $10,000 in cash. So the policy of the store was, as we get close to $10,000 in cash, one of our employees walks right across the street to their bank branch. A perfectly natural, reasonable, legitimate business reason for making cash deposits frequently. And yet, with a mere suspicion and virtually no investigation, again, the federal government seized his bank account. Those kinds of stories, I think, are just outrageous. And the fact that the government keeps doing them, I've seen dozens of cases like this now in the past few years that I've been litigating this area. It's just time for civil forfeiture to end.
Yeah, really. I mean, it's the kind of level of corruption that you think about in a country like, say, Mexico. We're speaking with Larry Saltzman, who is involved in trying to right this awful wrong. Larry, how did you get into this kind of litigation? What kind of training or background did you have that brought you to doing this good stuff?
Well, I went to law school, like all lawyers, and loved constitutional law, and found a way to do it full-time. The Institute for Justice provides a wonderful opportunity to do that. And, you know, I'm passionate that property rights are important to secure all the basic rights of Americans, and IJ does a lot of this work. So we looked into civil forfeiture. You know, it's an area of law where the government is acting without effective limits, where judges are not paying enough attention, where ordinary Americans and, you know, as you referred to earlier, sometimes people who are easily demonized or not understood or taken advantage of by law enforcement. And we thought it's just an important area to try to get involved in and protect people's basic rights.
Larry Saltzman, it's been a pleasure to learn more about civil forfeiture and the good work of the Institute of Justice. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.